what's really interesting is at a resting state, if you don't take any synonidics, the level of beta gal indicates how much senescence you have. But if you take a synonidic, the beta gal activity actually goes up if the synonidic works. So it becomes a very efficient monitoring tool for the relative efficacy of synonidics. I am at the 2024 Spring Conference of the American Association of Anti-Aging Medicine. I had the pleasure to catch up with a famous doctor, Dr. Joseph Pirita, who is probably the foremost expert in regenerative medicine. Dr. Pirita.
Well, thank you so much. Wow,
has been involved in anti-aging and regenerative medicine for a long time, and I always go to him for advice when I have questions, and we have been friends for over 2 years.
Oh, I think even a little more than that.
Yeah, probably more than that. So you just gave a fantastic talk at a conference. You talk about probably over 20 different treatment or anti-aging methodologies. And I really learned a lot, and I think it's really exciting. And for our viewers, I would like for you to tell them a little bit about probably we'll focus on the top three or five technologies that are really going to change the anti-aging medicine field and how we can help the folks to extend, I would say, their health span and probably their lifespan.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you know, I have one slide in my talk in the beginning, cells not doctors heal patients, because no matter what we do, we have to have the cells in our body heal things. So our job is to make those cells as healthy as we can. And that's the real basis of regenerative medicine, making your cells healthier. And I think what it really comes down to, and this is where the mitochondria are so important, and this is why things like NMN are so important, because without your mitochondria, you're finished. No matter, I don't care what you're going to have done, that's so important for your health. To me, that's the number one health issue in the world, deficient mitochondria.
I totally agree with you. You have several posts on LinkedIn that I read, and there was just a recent paper that you talk about, and why mitochondria is so important for health, not only for energy production. Obviously, energy is important to power our cells. Without mitochondria is basically our power plant.
Correct.
And to produce energy. Without mitochondria, there are no cells, there are no, we don't exist.
It'd be like society
anymore.
Would be without any power plants. We'd be in the dark.
Right. So in addition to produce energy, mitochondria is also the place where free radicals are produced. And that's where damages to our cell membranes and our macromolecules, DNA, RNA, and the protein snippets are destroyed by free radicals. I know you have a lot of knowledge and experience. Can you expand a little more on
that? Now, free radicals are, you know, basically where you have an unmatched electron, and that's what does the damage. But sometimes some free radical formation is important. We don't want to eliminate all. For instance, we do a treatment called EBO2, where we're literally using ozone in the blood. Now, the ozone will react and cause some oxidative stress, but a mild amount. There's something in medicine we call the hormesis effect, where a certain concentration of a bad thing, so to speak, can actually be a good thing, because what it does is it stimulates certain pathways in the body. And I want people to think of this as the following. Your organs and your cells are the computer hardware. The pathways are the computer software. When you have a problem with your computer, what do you want to do? You want to reboot it. That's what we're trying to do with these pathways. We want to reboot them because they get viruses, both literal and figurative, in their pathways and things like that. So oxidative stress can be good. It can be bad. Our job is to make it so it's our buddy and not our enemy.
So number one, mitochondrial function or dysfunction, and you know, one way is to boost the NAD production, make the energy production more efficient, avoid oxidative stress. All these are extremely important, and it's probably, you know, one of the most important tools to combat diseases and extend the health span. Do you want to add some more to that?
I do, but maybe I'll make it second, maybe not, I don't know. So the other thing is, we know that we want to make the mitochondria healthy, but we also want to increase their number. So that's part two. How can we do that? Well, we can do that by intermittent fasting. We can do that by basically hypoxia in a very controlled manner, because that's one of the most powerful stimulators of what we call mitogenesis, mitochondrial genesis, mm-hmm. making new mitochondria. So it's not just getting what we have healthier, it's making more of them, because we lose them as time goes on. I'm not sure, maybe you can tell me better, being the PhD of this team. Do our mitochondrial numbers go down as we age?
Our mitochondrial numbers do go down.
That's what I thought.
With age. And also our mitochondrial function goes down even more with age.
Right. And the other thing is, mitochondria, not like you say, not just for energy. They're important signaling. They make important signaling molecules. And we should also be aware of that mitochondria have a different DNA than the rest of the DNA in our cells. We basically inherit that DNA from our moms. So you have to bring your mother for your health of your mitochondria.
Yeah. Mitochondria has its own DNA. It's a circular DNA.
A circular,
16,000 base pairs.
Little basic.
16,500 some base pairs. I don't remember the exact one. And also, when we age, there are more free mitochondrial DNA in our blood as well. So as mitochondria get damaged, mitochondrial DNA can be released into the blood circulation. That's one of the biomarkers that can become actually very interesting to monitor mitochondrial function. It's not explored yet in the field, but my career starting with studying mitochondria in evolutionary biology sense, so I know a little bit about mitochondria.
In my own evolution, I used to kind of say, I don't need to know that anymore. I'm out of medical school now, but then I kind of did an about face and said, you really need to know the basic science to make things work better. There's no shortcuts, simple as that.
Right, so since the number of mitochondria is so important, do you know what are the efficient ways to boost the number of mitochondria?
Well, you know, some of them are common sense ways, but sometimes common sense is not common, as I say. But you can basically a proper diet, okay? You basically want to exercise. You know, high-intensity exercises, things like that will increase the mitochondrial number and their health. Certainly, I think you have to take a number of supplements, NMN, NR, whatever your choices are. I think NMN is a great one. Other things, there's one supplement you and I actually have spoken about, Urolithin A.
Yeah.
I'm very fond of that supplement because what that does, it helps recirculate the mitochondria. It kind of basically is kind of like a judge and says, you're damaged too much, I'm going to destroy you, but use your parts. Or, hey, you know what, I think we can fix you up. So that's another important aspect of the treatment. And again, just good, clean living is the most important thing of all, I think.
Yeah, and also inhibition of AMPK activities can boost the number of mitochondria and also function of
mitochondria. Like barberine, for instance.
I'm
a big fan of barberine. I think that's such a... I take that every day. I mean, I take a handful of supplements every day without fail.
I absolutely agree with you, and we are actually making a barberine supplement, a new formulation to make it more efficient. It's
You know, it's interesting. A lot of the anti-aging circles out there, they still tout metformin. And to me, metformin is... Look, at one time I was taking it, not because I had diabetes, for anti-aging, anti-cancer, etc. But metformin can sometimes nullify some of the effects of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Barberine does not. That's why barberine, to me, is a hands-down better choice.
All right. Very good. So I think we're talking a lot about the mitochondria and mitochondrial function. What's the number two action that you think is very important for anti-aging?
Inflammation. You know, there's the word inflammaging. where you combine inflammation and aging together. Get down inflammation, you get down, so you slow down aging. Increase aging, you increase inflammation. So that's another thing. And that's sort of in a way related to mitochondria. Again, everything kind of funnels down, as I tell people in my office, to your mitochondria. But you've got to reduce inflammation, or you're not going to succeed.
Inflammation is the root cause of almost all aging-related diseases. You're absolutely right. And there are different types of inflammation as well. I think the question is how we can identify the sources of inflammation and what are the best biomarkers for inflammation one can test. And then on the second part of the question is what are the best actions we can take to reduce actions?
Well, and again, and this is something I've spoken to you in the past about. As you say, there are certain biomarkers, and some of these biomarkers are caused by or released by what we call senescent cells, which are zombie cells. These are cells that should have died but did not die. Now, unfortunately, they continue to go on, so to speak, and lo and behold, they will cause other cells to become diseased and sick. They secrete many different growth factors. And the crazy thing, and this is what gets me, there's a lot of clinics out there, they want to give patients all sort of supplements, and I say, well, that's all well and good, you're giving supplements, but realize you're also making these zombie cells, these senescent cells, healthier, which you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. So many times you need to give what we call a senolytic agent, which is something that can help take care of these cells. Some good ones out there like fusitin, quercetin, things like that. I mean, we are big believers in the senolytics and other things. Senomorphics, senotherapeutics is actually the best word of all, because you want to have your immune system be able to get rid of these cells. You want to basically kill them and get rid of them. You want to have the undertakers take them away, so to speak.
I totally agree with you, and I think senescence is one of the six major risk factors of war. Aging-related diseases.
We do need some senescent cells, though. That's
the
thing.
Well, senescence is involved in wound healing.
Yeah, perfect.
That's the most important one.
Like
we're
always.
On the same page.
Okay.
Yeah. But in general, too much senescence is not good for health.
Exactly.
Extensive data showing that senescence, especially the biomarker beta-galactosidase, what we call it sometimes beta-gal, is highly increased in...
And that's a good biomarker to measure.
Yeah, in patients with many diseases. We have also shown that beta-gal and senescence burden determines how a cancer patient responds to chemotherapy and it determines the survival. We have done a very large study on cervical cancer with over 1,000 patients. What we have shown is patients with lower senescence have 5 times better survival than cervical patients high senescence.
No question.
It's a risk factor that the anti-aging field and the biohacker field have paid much attention in the last few years, but the mainstream medicine has not. Well, no, the NIH is now paying a little more attention to senescence.
But they're still missing the boat, but they're slowly paddling to it little by little.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the senolytics. And there are a number of them that have been used. And the best one that's known is quercetin and fisetin. And many people are using that. I actually use a protocol that contains 1,000 milligrams of quercetin and 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. And vitamin C and quercetin can synergize to increase senolytic activity.
There is a, again, it escapes me which one it is, but there's a certain form of vitamin E that's also very potent as a senolytic. You know, vitamin E can be, you know, good or bad, but there's, I believe, what, 4 different forms of it?
Yeah, it's tocopherol.
And that one's very good. I actually helped design a supplement a couple of years ago that had a couple of these things in there. You know, of course, there's the one medicine we're using off-label, the statinib. but that's a leukemia medicine we use off-label. And that works pretty good, but it's very expensive. I have to get it from outside the United States in order to use it because it's just too expensive here. But I'm not sure you need to use that anymore. I think we have nutraceuticals that can do probably just as good a job.
I agree with you. So the dasatinib and quercetin, or the D plus Q protocol,
that was in the universities, and that was the first time, for instance, I think it was pulmonary fibrosis, the first time they actually had any kind of treatment that improved the patient.
Yeah. The first clinical trial was done in the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, in Florida, not far away from here.
No.
And then there are a number of other studies. Some have been published, most have not been published. And the D plus Q is probably a good protocol, but there are also other pharmaceuticals or supplements that can be used, and rapamycin is one that is believed to be to have some synonymic activities. And also grape seeds, and that seems to be pretty good synonymic.
Yeah, grape seed is something that's, to me, it's like a wonder supplement.
Yeah.
So many different things it can do.
Right. So I think the main issue that we're still facing is what's the best biomarker for senescence. Beta-gal is quite a reasonable one.
I think that's a good starting point, definitely.
And we know we can use it to monitor the activities of synonidics. What's really interesting is at a resting state, if you don't take any synonidics, the level of beta-gal indicates how much senescence you have. But if you take a synonidic, the beta-gal activity actually goes up if the synonidic works. So it becomes a very efficient monitoring tool for the relative efficacy of synonidics.
Yeah, that's good.
And we have now at least 4 or 5 clinical trials, and unfortunately the data have not been published. And in every single time, if we see clinical benefits and if synonidics are used in the protocol, we actually see increased beta-gal activity while inflammation, oxidative stress, and other biomarkers may improve. So that really gives us confidence that beta-gal is actually a very good monitoring biomarker.
No, I know you and I have spoken about this in the past, and you're absolutely right. And I think you have probably the most efficient and best ways of checking them of any place I know. I mean, even you looked at these other places.
Thank you. All right. So now let's talk about the third treatment with biotics that is on your top 3 list.
Third treatment. Well, you know, I mean, they're all sort of...
You talk about it a lot today.
Oh, well, stem cell therapy.
Stem cells. Yes. Let's talk about the stem cells.
Stem cells. So basically, one cell that I'm very fond of, and I've been involved with it for years, is something called a V cell, a very small embryonic-like stem cell. Now, basically, we have a few ways of doing this. First of all, we give some supplements ahead of time. We give one supplement called Fucoidin. Now, Fucoidin is an algae that's found off a lot of the blue zones. In this particular one, we use from the coast of Okinawa. Now, we know the people of Okinawa are very long-lived. So this Fucoidin, we feel, when we give it ahead of time, it stimulates the bone marrow to produce these V cells, very small embryonic cells. But they're quiescent. They're not really active. So we harvest them, then we mix them with what we call a platelet lysate, which is growth factors that we get from blood platelets, and put them overnight at 4 degrees centigrade in low oxygen. And we give them back intravenously the next day. And they have been known to do some very interesting things. We've, you know, anecdotally seen some very good results with them. And we're about to do a study on them now, looking for, among other things, clethoprotein. We were talking about that.
All right. So, yeah, let's talk about the V cell and the stem cell in general, and then we can come to closer.
Okay.
So stem cells have been around for decades, and I think good outcomes have been obtained with various types of stem cells. You talk about different types
well,
today.
You know, right. Interestingly enough, some of the results for me, you know, being an orthopedic surgeon by training, it's fairly easy for me to put some of these cells in a joint because they're easy to deliver there and easy to keep them there. And you do it at heart, it's a little more difficult. But nevertheless, we're making progress on all fronts. We give them some of them intravenously. I'm a big fan of what we call autologous, meaning that it's from the patient themselves. But I think we're going to see, under the right circumstances, that we'll use mesenchymal cells from placenta sources and umbilical sources and things like that. But we have to be careful about some of these things, and there could be a potential allergic reaction. But I think still there's a lot of good benefits that we can get. And one of the things, going back to what we first started talking about, we now know that some of the things that these stem cells will do is they will actually transfer mitochondria to diseased cells. And that's how they may actually renovate them. They may actually say, hey, look, I'm going to give you a mitochondria. I'm going to give you a mitochondria, and you'll be good to go. Because maybe it's like having a part in your car where the car works great except for one part is bad. Like the fuel pump is bad or something. Yeah. You change the fuel pump, oh, the car works great again.
I mean, that's a great, very interesting observation. Now, I'm not an expert on stem cells, but there are two questions that have been on my mind.
Okay.
The first one is, how do you evaluate the quantity of stem cells before you put them into a patient? And the second question is, how do you monitor the efficacy or the outcome of the treatment?
Okay, so basically, you know, realize we're not a big university center. So we can sometimes do some flow cytometry. It gives us an idea of the number of cells, but it's still tough to really evaluate their viability. You'd have to send them off to a lab to do a culture analysis and see exactly how many cells are forming. CFUs, culture forming units. But we'll do that, and then we'll really, our most important thing is how the patient is doing, mm-hmm. our observations.
Absolutely.
Now, we also do some things down the road. We may see if we can get an MRI to show some, improvements and things like that. You know, I tell patients, we don't cure you with stem cells. We're not at that point where we're curing people, but we can make it better. And one of the things I like to tell patients is, one of the things that we attempt to accomplish with stem cells is, for instance, when we're talking about a joint, we want to change the chemistry of the joint so it's not inflamed all the time. Stem cells are like little biochemical factories. They can basically produce growth factors that can reduce inflammation and keep it at bay for quite some time.
Great, thank you. Finally, let's talk about a closol. What's a closol?
Well, that's an interesting compound. I got to tell you a funny story. I mean, I kind of feel good about talking. I was going to be involved in a study where I was going to wear a suit that was electrified. Idea mm-hmm. being that it'll stimulate the muscles and it hopefully will produce more cletho protein. So they said, you got to get a blood level first. I said, okay, fine. I mean, I try and take good care of myself. I'm, all kinds of good things. So I got the blood level back. And, my head nurse had a little smile on her face and a little snicker. She said, well, you got your level back. I said, okay. And I looked, and it was I was in the 90th percentile. Mm-hmm. I said, good. But it was the 90th percentile of the 18 to 35-year-olds. So I said, I guess I'm going to not do that study, and I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So there you are. But I think it's a very important thing. We know that not just a protein, but it's sort of like a biomarker, I guess. We could consider that. And we know that it's very much associated with longevity. Now, that doesn't mean if you have it, you're going to be fine. You can just live a bad life and stuff like that. But I'd rather have a high level than a low level. Let's put it that way. And, that makes me feel good.
Yeah, closol is considered one of the most important longevity protein. And there are many clinics and companies working on the protein. And we at Genfinity actually has developed a very efficient closol.
That's what I
test.
Need to know, because I'm talking to another doctor that I'm working with closely, and we think that the V cells will increase it, but we want to do something to check and
that's I think finding efficient ways to increase the closol level is going to be very important initiative.
That's going to be the next big thing in regenerative medicine.
It's in the next big thing. I totally agree with you. And we have done a few small studies, and There are some supplements, and you mentioned the vest, and there are a number of candidates, but so far, I have not found anything that really works in large scale.
I'm not familiar with one either. I'm looking, I'm reading
every
day.
We continue to look, and I'm working with another clinic on a clinical trial. I'm writing the IRB protocol right now, and let's work together to find the affordable, efficient
Absolutely.
Ways to increase cortisol level, and among many other things. Now, I want to end by asking your own anti-aging or longevity protocol and what lessons we can learn from you and our viewers can learn from you.
Okay, 7 days a week, I'm up at 4 a.m. I read for 1 hour. Then I go out and walk for about 4 miles, hour, 10 minutes or so. Then I come back, I do my elliptical for about 25 minutes, getting my heart rate into 140s. I watch TV while I do it, though, some old shows or something. And then I go ahead and swim, and then I get to my office. And that's a 7-day regimen. I don't necessarily go to the office 7 days, maybe 5 days to the office, but that's 7 days a week. I do intermittent fasting during the week for about 18 hours. And try to, listen, I cheat some here and there. As far as beef, I maybe eat one half a hamburger a week, eat some chicken and stuff like that, follow something of a Mediterranean diet. Do some modalities. I take a handful of supplements every day. I mean, that's beyond question. And I'm continuing to work, which keeps me young, I think, and keeps me vigorous.
My personal goal is to be able to play tennis in my late 90s, or maybe over 100. What's your personal goal?
My personal goal is the same as yours. I want to live a long life, but I want to be healthy and enjoy it. Okay, I want my health span to be there, and basically be there until the very end, around 100 or so. But you never know. Maybe let's see what happens in the next decade or two.
That's great. We totally agree. We want to help everyone to extend their health span. You have a date, and we're going to play a tennis game or whatever your favorite sport in 40, 50
Someone
years from
I've
now.
Always respected and will continue to respect.
Thank you.
Thank you.